From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Paul Reubens, who created Pee-wee Herman. But before he starred in Pee-wee's Playhouse, Reubens thought he might join the circus.
I'd get up on the balance beam with a blindfold on and, like, set these rings on fire and do this completely insane act. Like, look, I pulled the blindfold off and looked at my parents, and they were both sitting up in the bleachers with their mouths open, like, what have we created?
Pee-wee's back in a new show on Broadway. Also, rock historian Ed Ward tells us the story behind the many hits of songwriters P.F. Sloan and Steve Barry, and critic-at-large John Powers reviews a new Elia Kazan DVD box set. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli of TVWorthWatching.com, sitting in for Terry Gross.
Hey, Pee-wee. Do you know what time it is?
It's fun time! It's fun time!
That's Paul Reubens, who rose to fame as his antic alter ego, Pee-wee Herman. His CBS children's show, Pee-wee's Playhouse, ran from 1986 to 1991. Now, almost 25 years after bringing Pee-wee to television, Paul Reubens has revived Pee-wee and his Playhouse in a whole new venue. On Broadway, as the opening production of the newly christened Stephen Sondheim Theater. The Broadway show runs through January 2nd and essentially is an extended live version of the CBS series. Pee-wee's Playhouse, both the TV show and its new Broadway incarnation, features a great cast of characters. Even the inanimate objects are alive. The chair, the window, and the daisies on the windowsill can all talk. On the TV show, a puppet band of beatnik-style hipsters played jazz, sang, and talked in rhymes. The food in the refrigerator was alive. And in each episode, a robot-like boombox named Conky printed out a secret word.
Ready to assist you, Pee-wee.
Morning, Conky.
What's today's secret word?
Today's secret word is
good.
Now, you all know what to do whenever anybody says a secret word, right?
Scream!
That's right.
For the rest of the day, if anybody says a secret word,
scream real loud. Ready? Let's try it.
Cool cats pounding out the beat.
And we're responding with our feet.
Like they're dancing, man.
I can dig it. Hey, let me try rhyming.
Cool.
I'd talk like you do if I could.
Come on, Pee-wee, you're doing good.
A great big scream is what we heard.
I must have said the secret word.
This rhyming's fun, I agree, but now it's time to play with me.
Hey, Magic Screen, that was really good!
Paul Reubens spoke to Terry Gross in 2004. I think the interview is pretty good.
Well, let's start at the very beginning of the birth of Pee-wee Herman. How did you first create the character? I think this was back in the Groundlings era when you were working with that improv comedy group.
Yeah, it was, I believe, 1977. I was three, and we were doing a night where we were kind of doing an extended scene, what we called an extended scene, and we were trying to do something where it was like a comedy club, like the Comedy Store or the Improv. And we were all supposed to be different characters that you might see in a comedy club. So I decided to be the guy at the comedy club that everybody would like immediately know this guy was never going to make it as a comic. And part of it was because I couldn't remember jokes in real life. I couldn't remember the punchline, or I'd get halfway through the joke and I was always the guy who'd be like, oh, wait, no, I forgot to tell you this part, you know. So that's and that character just sort of came out that night. I mean, I borrowed a suit from the director of the Groundlings, Gary Austin. I borrowed his suit, which had been made for him by a guy named Mr. J, if he's out there listening. And somebody else gave me a little tiny bow tie. I had a little one-inch long harmonica that said Pee-wee on it. And I knew a kid whose last name was Herman. And Pee-wee Herman sounded like the kind of name you would never make up. It sounded like, you know, a totally real name, like made by somebody whose parents were, you know, didn't really care about them.
So did you make up intentionally bad jokes?
You know, I don't think I even had jokes at the time. I think, like, basically I had a paper bag full of toys, and I would bring them out and just go like, you know, it was really sort of kind of a pathetic kind of act. I didn't do jokes for many, many years. And then I think the first time I ever told a joke as Pee-wee was on David Letterman's show. And I used to have, I loved really long jokes. So it was like a story that was a joke. And then I would halfway through go like, oh, I forgot this part. And I'd have to go back and It was just a big, long, long joke where, fortunately for me, it was a really funny punchline. So just when you were listening to it going, oh, my God, if this doesn't, like, if this isn't over in 30 seconds, I'm going to shoot myself, there would be a really funny punchline and it would all be okay.
So how did this really bad comic, Pee Wee Herman, develop into the kid show host, Pee Wee Herman?
You know, I'm not sure there was much development involved. I mean, I that character got such a great response on the first night that it ever appeared that I very quickly realized, like, this is something to pursue. So I did pursue that character. And in the Groundlings review, I had about maybe a 10-minute slot as Pee Wee Herman. So I had about 10 minutes worth of, here's my toys, and I threw Tootsie Rolls at people in the audience. And about, I don't know, a year after I was doing it in the Groundlings review, I was flown to New York to be one of the finalists for Saturday Night Live, the year that the last original cast member was gone. It was the first year of an all-new cast. It was the Eddie Murphy, Joe Piscopo year. And it was the first and only year that Lorne Michaels didn't produce. And I was one of 22 finalists all across the country, Chicago, San Francisco, New York, and L.A. And I flew to New York, and with all my characters, I had, like, my fat suit. I had a fat guy character and all my props and wigs. And I walked in, and I realized almost immediately I wasn't going to get it. Somebody pulled me aside and said, that guy over there is the producer's best friend. And it was somebody who did get on the show, whose name I won't mention, who was very similar. I mean, we were both kind of like nerdy, dorky guys. So I knew it wasn't going to be both of us. And the Pee Wee Herman show actually developed completely out of spite that I didn't get Saturday Night Live. I was so upset. And people, I literally was thinking to myself, I'm going to go from this, like, up-and-comer guy to, like, you know, the guy sitting out in front of Rite Aid, like, you know, tucking on your pant leg, going, like, you know, can you help me out? Without ever having, you know, anything going. So before I even went home, I landed in Los Angeles and called my parents and borrowed some money from them. And probably within 2 weeks, I had 60 people working for me for free. And we produced that show.
So, well, let's talk about the creation of the Saturday morning version of Pee-wee's Playhouse.
Okay.
Let's start with your voice, since you're speaking to us on the radio. Obviously, you didn't use your regular voice for the character of Pee-wee. How did you arrive at that kind of high and laughy voice that you created?
You know, I had been doing years before the creation of Pee-wee Herman, I worked at a theater that was the State Theater of Florida called the Oslo Theater, which is still in existence, still a fantastic place, which was in my hometown, Sarasota, Florida, and was based at the John and Mabel Ringling Museum of Art, which Sarasota, as you may or may not know, was the former headquarters of the winter headquarters of the Ringling Brothers Circus, so there's a lot of Ringling influence there. And I had been doing Life with Father in repertory with a bunch of other shows. And my character, I was the second oldest son, not the star son, but the second banana son. And over a 3-month period, and I'm not bragging about this, this probably wasn't a good thing, but my character developed into this total cartoon character. And I didn't really even realize it, but you know, 3 months down the line, somebody said, wow, do you remember what you were originally doing and what you're doing now? And I was like, wow, it is really different. So the voice came from that. That is Pee-wee's voice. It was from, you know, good morning, mother, you know, blah, blah, blah. And that became Pee-wee's voice.
So
I love that story.
So from doing theater, you developed the voice for Pee-wee?
Yep. You sound incredulous.
Well, it sounds like it must have been pretty cartoony by the time it was done.
It was. It was pretty cartoony.
How did that happen? Did you not like the play?
You know, I don't know. No, I loved the play. I thought it was a really great play. I think I just wasn't very professional. I was an idiot. I didn't know you weren't supposed to like change it completely into a cartoon. It was unwittingly. I did it unwittingly, Jerry.
Now, the way you looked as Pee-wee Herman, with your hair slicked back and the face makeup with the rouge and a little bit of lipstick, reminded me almost of like a silent film star, like a really nerdy version of a silent film star. It was something almost, you know, like Valentino with the slicked back hair, and I always assumed that those guys wore like a little lipstick and rouge too, you know, in the black and white movies. Were you thinking about that as well, visually?
I feel like I was around back then. You know, I was a big fan of a bunch of people, but not real. I whatever happened, I think, must have been kind of subliminal with me, because I never really, once Pee-wee Herman was successful and people knew Pee-wee Herman, then people wrote quite often, you know, Eddie Cantor or... Who's the other person? Like some of the, like Harold Lloyd, some of the silent... people you're talking about, even Pinky Lee, who I had seen as a kid, but I mean, and Jerry Lewis, who, if you're listening, Jerry, I know you're not a silent star. I'm sure that all those elements had some sort of play on it, but I never really tried to like look like anybody in particular. And the makeup really was kind of like I didn't have a makeup artist. I mean, I did it myself, so I wasn't really trying to look like I had lipstick or rouge on. I was just like, I didn't know how to do it.
No, your body.
I love that story too.
as Pee Wee Herman, your body was just like really kind of tight and a little jerky, and you would always be like leaning to one side, or your head would be, you know, angled at one side. You'd often like stick your tongue out if you were concentrating in the way that kids often do. Was there a particular like kid you modeled yourself on as Pee-wee?
No, there really wasn't. I think it was just a blend of lots of people I knew and kind of like a lot of who I really was down deep somewhere, I think.
How deep?
Not that deep.
Paul Rubens, a.k.a. Pee-wee Herman, speaking to Terry Gross in 2004. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's 2004 interview with Paul Rubens. His new stage comedy, The Pee-wee Herman Show, opened on Broadway last night as the inaugural production of the Stephen Sondheim Theater. The stage show is based on Pee-wee's Playhouse, the wildly fanciful CBS children's show in which Rubens starred from 1986 to 1991. Here's another taste of that show, this time a musical number.
Playhouse! Playhouse on the rain.
Can we talk a little bit about the look of Pee-wee's Playhouse? It was just such a fantastic set of images, you know, bright colors, all kinds of like shapes, and everything was alive in it. You know, like the chair had arms that could embrace the person sitting in it, and the chair talked and the window talked. How was the look designed, and were you a part of that?
The look of the show really had a lot to do with an artist named Gary Panter, who designed the original stage version of it, and designed much of the was really the overall production designer, and created the look of the show, the television version of it. He was somebody who, when I was really creating that character in the early days of Pee-wee Herman, was kind of like the punk scene in Los Angeles, and he was kind of one of the premier punk artists. And I had seen a lot of his work. He was in a publication called the L.A. Weekly.
And in Raw Magazine that Art Spiegelman edited.
Exactly. And I'd seen a lot of his work, and I loved his work. And I contacted him and asked him if he would do a poster for a show that I hadn't created yet. And he said, well, why don't I do the poster? And well, actually, he said, let me come down and see what it is. So he came down and saw me in the Groundlings show, where I had my little 10-minute Pee-wee thing, and came backstage and said, I'd love to do it, but why don't I do the whole thing? Why don't I design the sets and the puppets and everything? And I said, yeah, great. So he designed that, and then when we got the deal with CBS a few years later to do it as a real television series, he came on board. He was the first person I hired and said, you know, you gotta do this set. So it was, the rest is history, I guess. But, I think it's probably the most amazing aspect of the show, in my opinion, is the design of it. It was just so startlingly incredible, in my opinion.
Now, you said that one of the things you really loved about the character of Pee-wee Herman was that he showed that it was okay to be different. What did you feel was most different about you when you were growing up?
I guess I felt like a total oddball almost every minute of growing up, so it'd be hard to kind of isolate that. But, I think that sort of was the whole point of the show, or at least a big point of the show, was that, it would be hard to stand out in the playhouse, everything stood out in the playhouse. So you could sort of feel right at home no matter who you are or what you were thinking or anything.
Tell us a little bit about what your childhood was like, where you grew up and what your school years were like. Were you uncomfortable in school? Did you do well in school? Were you picked on?
Well, I grew up in an orphanage and...
Oh,
okay.
No, you didn't.
No, I didn't. Oh, no, that was my fantasy character. Sorry. I grew up in upstate New York, Oneonta, New York. Until we moved in between third and fourth grade, we moved, which was like a huge relief to me because Mrs. Lake that I had in third grade was really mean to me and scared the hell out of me as far as math goes. Like I still to this day, if I got to add or subtract anything, I almost go into a coma. So I had an incredible upbringing in upstate New York, which included... The New York State Teachers College is in Oneonta, and there was a laboratory school that my sister and I went to, and we had junior kindergarten and senior kindergarten, which I think was an incredible confidence booster for like a little kid. You started at 4 in junior kindergarten, and by the time you were 5, you were already a senior at something. So you could always be like, those little junior kids and, junior kindergarten. Which was very cool to not have to wait till going from eighth grade to, you didn't have to wait till get to sixth grade to be like the big cheese. You got to do that at 5. And we lived in a really small town where there was lots of nature and animals, and we had a little creek with a crab apple tree across the street. I'm going to burst into tears in a second. it was really like a very storybook kind of upbringing. And then we moved to Florida. And moving to Florida was like incredible. I thought we moved to Hawaii. I thought we were in the tropics or something. And my mother took us to go get back to school clothes. And I bought all these beachcomber outfits. So I showed up for the first day of school in fourth grade in Florida with like clam digger pants on and these nautical shirts and like a total freak. And the kids at school were like, what are you supposed to be? And the thing that was funny about it in hindsight is like, normally I'm in that kind of situation. I think the kids would probably, you would probably go like, oh, sorry. I didn't know what it was. But me, I was totally like, don't you get it? You know, I'm a beachcomber. What's wrong with you guys? And instead, like, the next day, I, like, put out another variation of the same outfit, put it on, and got back to school and was like, you know, these kids are going to come around or they're not, whatever, but I'm not changing.
Was this your theatrical impulse expressing itself?
I think it was, yeah, at a very early, early stage.
Paul Rubens speaking to Terry Gross in 2004. His new Broadway showcase, The Pee-wee Herman Show, opened last night. We'll hear more about Pee-wee in the second half of the show. I'm David Bianculli, and this is Fresh Air.
She's the girl on the flying trapeze. She's the sweetest thing that's ever flown in with the breeze. And if you see her, tell her that I'm in love with her. She's the girl on the flying trapeze. The girl on the flying trapeze. She's the sweetest thing that's ever flown in with the breeze. And if you see her, tell her that I'm in love with her. She's the girl on the flying trapeze. Hey! She's the girl.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Lionsgate with Four Colored Girls, based on the play by Entezake Shange, starring Janet Jackson, Tandy Newton, and Whoopi Goldberg, now playing. From the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, making grants to solve social and environmental problems at home and around the world, on the web at hewlett.org. And from Angie's List, providing consumer reviews on local professionals from physicians and veterinarians to plumbers and roofers. Details at angieslist.com. This is NPR.
Coming up, John Powers reviews a new box set that collects 15 of the films by director Elia Kazan, including A Streetcar Named Desire. Ed Ward tells us about the songwriting team Sloan and Barry, who in the 1960s wrote hits for Herman's Hermits, The Mamas and the Papas, and The Turtles, and more with Paul Rubens, a.k.a. Pee-wee Herman, on being on The Howdy Doody Show and The Gong Show. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, sitting in for Terry Gross. We're continuing Terry's conversation from 2004 with Paul Rubens, a.k.a. Pee-wee Herman. But first, a quick detour. It's a safe bet that if you're an actor being interviewed by Terry, and you've ever appeared on the CBS children's show Pee-wee's Playhouse, she'll ask you a question about it. And in 2006, when Esapatha Merkerson was our guest, for many years she played Lieutenant Anita Van Buren on NBC's Law & Order, Terry did just that.
Now, on Pee-wee, you played Reba the Mail Lady.
Yeah.
And, in fact, why don't we hear a short clip of you on Pee-wee's Playhouse?
Oh, you're kidding.
Yes. And Pee-wee has made a wish And the wish is that Reba the Mail Lady will come to the playhouse and mail his letter. And Jambi the Genie has granted Pee-wee's wish, and you show up at the playhouse a little baffled, and you're in your nightgown. And here's the scene.
Hi, Reba.
Pee-wee.
How's it going?
What are you doing in my house?
I'm not in your house.
You're in the playhouse.
The playhouse? How did I get here?
Uh-oh.
Jambi, did you put a wish on me?
He made me do it.
You see,
I had this letter, and I wish that you were here to mail it for me.
Why didn't you just take it down to the corner and put it in the mailbox?
Well, as long as you're here, would you mind mailing this letter for me, please, Reba?
Pee-wee, I would do just about anything for you, but today is my only day off.
All right, I'll mail the letter myself.
Thank you.
Wait, Reba. Reba, wait.
You seem to be the only person on Pee-wee's show who is from, like, the real world as opposed to the playhouse world. And yours.
Yeah, yeah. And I think it was like that in real life, too.
What do you mean?
What a fun. That was fun to do.
So did you see yourself in that series as, like, the rational person in this wacky world?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think every now and then she became a part of it as well. But you know, that was the whole point, is that Reba was sort of, you know, the real person, the person that actually had, like, a real job and took care of, like, real things. And everyone else was a little kooky.
Esapaetha Murkerson speaking with Terry Gross in 2006 about her time on the CBS children's show Pee-wee's Playhouse. And now, back to Terry's 2004 interview with the star of that show, Pee-wee himself, actor Paul Reubens. When we left off, he was talking about moving with his family to Sarasota, Florida, when he was in fourth grade.
So when you moved to Sarasota, which you said was the winter headquarters for Ringling Brothers Circus, did you meet any circus people?
Oh, I met lots of circus people. I mean, for one thing, you could see the circus people coming down the street, you know, like the lady with the bright red hair and the wooden shoes, you know, would be obviously a circus person. I mean, you could just tell that they were very show business people in a very small town, a conservative small town. So you could tell who they were. We rented a little house the first year we moved to Sarasota, and we used to hear these explosions all the time. And we never could figure out what they were. And one day, a couple weeks after we moved, our whole family was walking. We took a walk one night after dinner, and we heard this explosion, and we looked in between these two homes. We saw somebody flying through the air in between these two homes. And it turned out that it was the Zucchini family, and they were the family with the giant silver cannon, and they were shooting each other out of a cannon in the backyard.
That's so
bizarre. And in fact, years later, when I made my circus movie, we went back to Sarasota and recreated that cannon.
For Big Top Pee-wee?
Yeah.
Wow.
you love
that
story?
Did you want to be in the circus after seeing this?
I did. You know, I actually thought that if I've been asked, like, what would have happened if you weren't successful as Pee-wee Herman, what would you have done? And I really thought I was headed for a career in the circus.
As
the pinheaded guy. No, the the unfunny guy. The guy who, I don't know, I knew how to walk a tightrope. I could do trapeze.
Could you really walk a tightrope?
Oh, yeah.
How'd you learn that?
Why would I make that up, Terry?
I don't know.
I went to circus camp when I was young.
Really?
Mm-hmm. I swear.
And did you ever do the Circus Barker rap?
No, I never did that. I considered briefly covering my body with tattoos, but I didn't do that, which is a good thing now because, you know, everybody has that now,
that's
so
right.
It wouldn't really be, like, you know, I'd be sad if I did that. I did, like, I started out, I had a balance beam act. My parents showed up to circus camp when we were putting on the show, and I had on, like, a little Speedo bathing suit, and I'd get up on the balance beam with a blindfold on and, like, set these, like, rings on fire and do this insane, completely insane act. Like, look, I pulled the blindfold out, off and looked at my parents. And they were both sitting up in the bleachers with their mouths open, like, what have we created? You know, like, totally. I think that was probably an early tip-off to them that I wasn't gonna be an architect.
So were you inhibited or extroverted as a kid?
One or the other?
Or something in between?
I think I was probably a little of each. I was sort of skitsy when I was like a kid. I would be like very introverted and in, you know, up in my room by myself. And then I would be like the life of the party, you know, like gathering all the kids around to like, we had a little stage in our basement that my dad built me once he realized he was raising a little monster actor. So the kids in the neighborhood would come over and try to figure out, like, what was the teeniest part they could give me so they could use the stage. So we would do, like, these murder mysteries where, like, the opening of the show would be me getting pushed off stage into a vat of acid. And then I would be, like, you know, my part would be over. And then all the older kids would, like, do the show. It wasn't until later in life I realized, you know, I'd come in and go, like, you've met my attorney, right? Let's see. You know, talk to them.
What TV shows did you watch as a kid?
I was part of an early study on the effects of television on children when I was going to that school in upstate New York I mentioned. I remember being in first or second grade and having some scientists come into our class to ask us questions about, like, what shows we liked. And all the rest of the kids were like, Mickey Mouse Club and Howdy Doody. And my favorite show was I Love Lucy. And so I got, like, selected out of the whole class. I had to go in to an office and listen to a bunch of scientists, like, go, like, well, what was it about the I Love Lucy show that that attracts you? And who do you like better, Lucy or Desi or Ethel or Fred? And, you know, I was, like, in second grade. I didn't know any. I just thought, like, well, I like the show just because I like the show. That's a long way to answer. I didn't even answer your question. I watched, in addition to I Love Lucy, when I was really young, I loved the Mickey Mouse Club. I loved Captain Kangaroo and I loved Howdy Doody. I was even on the Howdy Doody show. My mother drove me and my sister to New York and we were on the Howdy Doody show.
In the peanut gallery?
Mm-hmm. Somebody knows the Howdy Doody show. Good. Impressive.
What was it like to be inside rather than watching it on the TV?
Very confusing. I remember my sister was so freaked out. She burst into tears right before the show, and she had to be, like, put in an isolation booth. She didn't make it. She didn't make it on the air. But I did. I was like, after this drive, you got to be kidding. Try to axe me from the show. Forget it. I was right up in there. But the thing that was weird about it was, like, you couldn't see Howdy Doody. You couldn't see anything except, like, all the lights and cameras. And, I mean, it was really weird and kind of semi-disappointing.
Why was it disappointing? Because you couldn't see?
Yeah, just because I didn't realize that there were lights and cameras. And, you know, it's something interesting, like, from that experience, I now kind of, when I meet little kids, you know, out and about, like, for, like, we did the DVD signing the other day here in Manhattan, and 1,000 fans showed up, and I spoke to lots and lots of people, including some kids who would, you know, be just sort of staring at me, and I know enough now to say, like, I don't look like myself, do I, you know, and I look bigger, don't I, and that kind of stuff, because, you know, when you're a kid, like, it didn't occur to me that everything was real life size. You know, I thought Buffalo Bob was, like, you know, the size of somebody who could fit inside the TV.
Paul Rubens, thank you so much for talking with us.
Terry, thank you so much. I really appreciate it, and I had a lot of fun.
Paul Rubens speaking with Terry Gross in 2004. His new stage show, The Pee Wee Herman Show, opened last night on Broadway. Coming up, rock historian Ed Ward on a West Coast songwriting duo from the 1960s, P.F. Sloan and Steve Barry. This is Fresh Air. By the mid-1960s, the era of the contract songwriter on New York's Tin Pan Alley was coming to a close. It lived on, however, on the West Coast, where music publishers still hired teenage songwriters to make hits. P.F. Sloan and Steve Barry were the stars of that scene. And today, rock historian Ed Ward has the story of their many hits.
Hey, Mom, if any of the guys from my baseball team ever call me on the phone to ask me to play in an important game, just say their captain ain't at home. Tell them I'm surfing.
Don't care about hitting home runs.
Tell them I'm surfing.
Wanna have you some fun, fun, fun.
I'm training with my bat and ball. Say I'll see them in the fall. I'm going surfing. And if that
the Fantastic Baggies had their brief moment in surf music history with Tell 'Em I'm Surfin' being a very well-made, if unsuccessful, song. If it sounds familiar, it should. The song was recut by Jan and Dean, and the singers had already done vocal arrangements and performances on other records. In fact, the Baggies didn't exist. They were just another manifestation of the songwriting team of Phil Sloan and Steve Barry, who'd been thrown together by the West Coast office of Screen Gems Music to write follow-ups to hits. They'd already made records as the Lifeguards, Willie and the Wheels, Themes Incorporated, and several other groups, and Lou Adler, their boss, had faith in them. Sloan was born Phil Schlein in 1945, and Steve Barry was born Steve Lipkin in 1942, but although they were both New Yorkers, their parents moved the families to Los Angeles, where Sloan started writing and recording songs for some small labels, and Barry got a job in a music store, where he heard lots of records and learned some guitar chords. Sloan was Screen Gems' token teenager, and as well as writing songs, he was supposed to listen to records. In 1963, a British guy named Brian Epstein sent him some records by a group called the Beatles, and he was floored. Adler tossed them, at which point Sloan offered to buy them from him. Adler was impressed enough to get on the phone with VJ Records, who wound up buying the rights. In 1965, Sloan had another revelation, Bob Dylan. The kind of formulaic songwriting shops like Screen Gems produced was definitely over, and a new day had arrived. Sloan sat down and wrote a bunch of new songs, one of which was immediately recorded by a band from Liverpool, The Searchers.
Don't try and understand me. You never could do that. On in the end, you'd wind up being hurt. I'm a man with too many problems that keep pounding on my brain. So if you want me, you take me for what I'm worth. If you want me, you take me for what I'm worth.
At this point, Lou Adler saw what was happening and left Screen Gems to set up the Dunhill label and music publishing firm, offering Sloan and Barry double their present salaries to come work for him. Sure enough, one of their first efforts was another fake band, the Grassroots, who had a big West Coast hit with their first record.
Don't bother crying, don't bother crawling, it's all over now, no use in stalling. The love I once felt, I don't feel anymore for you. This time I'll even open the door for you. You walked out when I was down, when I
Another artist on Dunhill didn't need a fake name. Sloan's discovery of Dylan was pushing him further from pop and closer to what he called people's music. In 1965, Dunhill released the first album by P.F. Sloan, Songs of Our Times, which included a track he'd written for a former member of the New Christie Minstrels.
The Eastern world, it is exploding, violence flaring and bullets loading. You're old enough to kill, but not for voting. You don't believe in war, but what's that gun you're toting? And even a Jordan River has bodies floating. But you tell me over and over and over again, my friend, oh, you don't believe the eve of destruction. Don't you understand?
Eve of Destruction was a number one hit for Barry McGuire, while Sloan's version stayed on his album. And while the McGuire record was banned by many radio stations, the single Sloan released was banned by almost all of them.
She had a bad childhood while she was very young, so don't judge her too badly. She had a schizophrenic mother who worked in the gutter, would have sold herself to the devil gladly. What a sad environment, a bug-ridden gentleman. And when they couldn't pay the rent, it's cause her father was out getting sicker. Our stone's been cast in blood, thicker than water. And the sins of a family fall on the daughter. All the sins of a family fall on the daughter.
Dunhill packed Sloan and McGuire off to tour England, where both records had taken off, and when Sloan returned, he saw things very differently. The kids wanted protest music, he decided, but in America, the man was keeping it from them. In retrospect, though, it looks a little different. Eve of Destruction didn't really have a viewpoint, and Sins of a Family clubs you over the head with one. What Phil Sloan and Steve Barry did best was pop. And throughout 1966, they wrote hits for Herman's Hermits, the Mamas and Papas, and the Turtles. But eventually, Sloan simply walked out and disappeared. For years, all people knew of him was his name, thanks to a song by Jimmy Webb, whom he'd helped get started in the songwriting business. Steve Barry kept producing for Warner Brothers and Motown, and Sloan reappeared with an album in 2006 and has done some touring. But the last great song factory in L.A. was closed.
Rock historian Ed Ward played music from two Sloan and Barry collections, You Baby, Words and Music by P.F. Sloan and Steve Barry, and P.F. Sloan, Here's Where I Belong, the very best of the Dunhill years, 1965 to 1967. Coming up, critic-at-large John Powers on a new DVD box set of films by director Elia Kazan. This is Fresh Air. The late theater and film director Elia Kazan had a profound influence on America in the decades after World War II. One of those he touched was filmmaker Martin Scorsese, who says that Kazan inspired him to make movies. Scorsese has selected the Kazan films that are included in a new DVD set called the Elia Kazan Collection. In addition to familiar classics like On the Waterfront, the collection includes Scorsese's cinema essay, Letter to Elia, and five Kazan films never before available on DVD. Such significant titles as A Tree Grows in Brooklyn, Viva Zapata, and America, America. Our critic at large, John Powers, says this is one collection that's as exciting for the films you don't know as for the ones you do.
It's one of life's teasing truisms that artists' landmark works aren't necessarily their best ones. A good example of this is Elia Kazan, one of the defining and polarizing figures in post-war American culture. Not only did Kazan help revolutionize the theater, he forever changed the movies, ushering in a whole new era of screen acting. He worked with the holy trinity of method dreamboats, Montgomery Clift, Marlon Brando, and James Dean, and he launched the likes of Warren Beatty, Lee Remick, and Eva Marie Saint. The trajectory of Kazan's career has now been charted in the Elia Kazan Collection, a box set featuring 15 of his key films. It's a terrific collection anchored by some of the most mythic performances in film history. Brando and Vivian Leigh in A Streetcar Named Desire. Brando again in On the Waterfront. He could have been a contender. And of course, Dean in East of Eden, a groundbreaking performance so quirkily histrionic in its vulnerability that, seen through today's wised-up eyes, Dean appears to be acting in a story by Kafka, not Steinbeck. These are films that everyone should see. But for me, the true pleasure of this set lies in other, lesser-known films that I actually like better. The finest is Wild River, a 1960 film set in the Tennessee Valley during the 30s. Cliff plays Chuck Glover, a young federal administrator who's been sent to get an ornery old matriarch, that's Jo Van Fleet, to leave her plantation before it's flooded. He winds up getting romantically involved with her widowed granddaughter, who's played by Remick with such intense purity of emotion and such blueness of eye that she takes your breath away. Here, Glover tells the old lady that the TVA dams will give everyone electricity, but she's not buying it.
I expect that's what you call progress, isn't it?
And you don't.
No, sir, I don't. Taking away people's souls, putting electricity in place of them, ain't progress. Not the way I see it.
We're not taking away people's souls. Just the opposite. We're giving them a chance to have a soul. And it isn't just this dam. It's dam after dam after dam. We aim to tame this whole river.
You do. Well, I like things running wild. Like nature meant. There's already enough dams locking things up. Taming them. Making them go against their natural wants and needs. I'm agin dams. Of any kind.
Kazan always had a fondness for cussed characters like that. No doubt because he was one himself. He was born of Anatolian Greek parents who emigrated to the U.S. when he was 4. It was a difficult life that made him a difficult man. In his great autobiography, A Life, he wrote that he woke up mad every single day. But his experience gave him an immigrant's sense of America, its possibilities and its harsh realities. And this led him to big, juicy American stories, usually with serious social themes. Kazan tackled everything from anti-Semitism in Gentleman's Agreement to public health in Panic in the Streets, a terrific New Orleans noir starring Richard Widmark as a military doctor who's trying to run down a gang of crooks infected with plague. My favorite of these social pictures is A Face in the Crowd, a riveting, nasty 1957 movie about a demagogic TV star played with sinister brilliance by an Andy Griffith you'd never let around Opie. You can foresee today's media culture in every frame. Although Kazan could be a clunky director, he made great use of locations, boasted a gritty sense of reality, and guided actors into unfamiliar psychological depths. He was superb at exploring personal relationships, be it the love between father and daughter in A Tree Grows in Brooklyn, exquisitely acted by James Dunn and Peggy Ann Garner, or the immigrant ruthlessness of the hero in America, America. Based on his own uncle's story, this fiercely unsentimental movie follows a young man who does what it takes, and it takes cruel things, to make it from Anatolia to American soil. Bursting with chutzpah, Kazan himself did whatever it took to make it big in America. Even as he enjoyed the fruits of success, he was a man who bragged about his sexual conquests. He joined in the Red Scare of the 50s, naming names in his testimony before the House Un-American Activities Committee. Although this tainted his own name in Hollywood to this day, it also made his subsequent movies far more interesting. Not coincidentally, his most powerful work is On the Waterfront, the story of an ex-boxer turned longshoreman, Brando's Terry Malloy, who informs on corrupt union bosses. In one of that film's most beautiful scenes, Terry and his girl, played by Eva Marie Saint, are up on a rooftop where he keeps pigeons. He tells it that the city is full of hawks. They hang around on the top of the big hotels, he says, and when they spot a pigeon in the park, they pounce. It's one measure of what made Kazan such a dominating figure that, more than half a century later, it's hard to be sure who he identified with more, the victimized pigeons or the predatory hawks.
John Powers is film critic for Vogue and Vogue.com. He reviewed the Elia Kazan collection, now out on DVD. You can join us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at NPR Fresh Air. And you can download podcasts of our show at freshair.npr.org.
Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham, with additional engineering support from Joyce Lieberman and Julian Hirschfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Melody Kramer is our associate producer of online media. Roberta Sharrock directs the show. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. For Terry Gross, I'm David Bianculli.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from FJC, a foundation of donor-advised funds working to maximize the effectiveness of charitable giving at fjc.org. From Plowshares Fund, dedicated to helping build a safe, secure, and nuclear weapon-free world at plowshares.org. And from the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age. This is NPR.
It's all over now. 21 songs Bruce Springsteen recorded for the album Darkness on the Edge of Town, but didn't include on it, are being released for the first time. On the next Fresh Air, we feature an onstage interview recorded at the Toronto Film Festival with Bruce Springsteen, conducted by actor Edward Norton. Join us. Yeah.